Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Duanna McBride. Thank you, Duanna. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you for attending today's CPD Solutions webinar on emergency diagnostics. So what I wanted to go through in this lecture is, you know, what bloods should we be taking when our patient first arrives to the emergency room? And how can we maximize the amount of diagnostic tests with the smallest amount of blood possible? And also by not going too crazy with spending too much money for the client. So we're going to go through a lot of things. There's going to be lots of sizes and different differentials and treatments and things, but the main focus on is, you know, just to give you a broad idea of, you know, what can we do in the emergency room with just a small drop of blood. If you do have any questions, you can contact CPD Solutions and they'll be able to help you there. And I can answer questions throughout the week. So the first thing I want to talk about is sampling the patient. So one of the biggest causes of anemia in human hospitals is actually iatrogenic causes of repeat sampling. And compared to human patients, our veterinary patients are often small, like these little guys here. Our patients are often very, very small, kind of like pediatrics and neonates. And so we need to be very careful about how much blood we're going to take, only take the amount we want, and try to maximize our diagnostic tests from that very small amount of blood. Other complications of sampling the patient can be also expenses to the client, bruising and bleeding, even if they're not coagulopathic, and also patient discomfort. I'm not going to go into detail about long-stay catheters or jugular catheters, also called central venous catheters, but if you do think you need to do repeated blood sampling, it's a good idea to place one of these long-stay catheters either in the jugular or in the subvenous vein in the dog. They might need some sedation. Sometimes you can do it conscious with local anaesthetic. But once you've placed it in, it means that, you know, there's no bother to the patient and also no bother to us taking the blood sample. So in the long run, you can save time and also improve patient comfort in the hospital. Some of the contraindications of jugular sampling, so times when we need to consider sampling from the saphenous or the sphalic vein, increased intraocular pressure, intracranial pressure, and coagulopathies. So if we are occluding the jugular vein, then we've got decreased venous return, resulting in potentially increased intracranial pressure or intraosseous pressure. One thing I do like to do is when I place my IV catheter, try to get some blood samples from that catheter. So that also minimizes patient comfort and allows us not to have to go to the jugular vein. So what I wanted to broadly speak about first, and it's probably going to take about the first half of the lecture, is anemia. Because I think without anemic patients, there's a lot we can do. And a lot of this focuses on, you know, what are we going to do if it's in the middle of night? We can't send blood samples out to the lab, or even if we do send blood samples into the lab, it's going to take 12 to 24 hours to get the blood samples back, you know, depending on what country you live in and what states, then sometimes it can also take several days. So that's why I think it's really important to emphasize the use of in-house clinical pathology in our emergency room. So the different causes of anemia can be divided into decreased production, increase in loss, and increase in destruction. And I've listed here several differential diagnoses. The way I like to think about differential diagnoses is I think about, you know, what the life cycle of the red blood cell is. So I think about, you know, where does the red blood cell come from? It comes from the bone marrow. So it could be due to bone marrow disease. What's important in producing it is erythropoietin from the kidneys, so potentially chronic kidney disease could be a problem, or other chronic inflammatory disease processes. Once the red blood cell enters into circulation, it can get lost due to hemorrhage, or there could be increased destruction secondary to other causes like IMHA, toxins, infection, as well as shearing injury. And I kind of view this method when I'm thinking about other disease processes or other problems, such as high or low potassium levels, what happens with the white blood cell, and thinking about it physiologically this way. I have already mentioned I will go through lots of differential diagnoses for things which I'm not going to read out, but I just felt like I needed to leave it in this lecture, otherwise it feels like it's a little bit of a missing piece of the puzzle. Once we've recognised our patient is anemic, we need to be able to characterise our anemia. And the four main things I'm going to go through is looking at PCV and total protein, looking at serum colour, autoagglutination, and using a blood smear. And you only really need, you know, less than like even 0.3 mils of blood to perform these tests. So when you're drawing a blood sample, always think in advance, you know, what other samples do I need? Other important things to characterize anemia that we won't go into too much detail is PT and APTT, looking at coagulation. So if you're drawing a blood sample from an anemic patient, I often just draw enough for that as well and just keep it on hold until I want to run it. Bilirubin will help performing thoracic focus ultrasounds or abdominal focus ultrasounds, as well as getting a good history and physical exam. Just by looking at the PCV in total solids alone, we can get a lot of information, and it costs very minimal amount to the client. So if you've got a low, I'll just get the arrow again. If we've got a low PCV and a low total protein, so both of them are low, it's most likely due to hemorrhage. If we've got a low PCV but a high total protein, then we must have loss of red blood cells or decrease in production of red blood cells, but no loss in total blood volume. So decreased production and increased destruction. If the PCV is normal, but the total solids is low, then one thing to think about is, could it be hemorrhage? This happens more so in dogs than in cats. So initially you might have a drop in PCV and total protein, but the spleen reserves helps pump out the red blood cells, which are in the spleen. And so often we have a high PCV, not usually high, but normal PCV relative to a low total protein initially. We don't see that much in cats because splenic contraction doesn't occur so much in cats compared to dogs. We could also have a decrease in protein production or intake, or increase in protein loss. I'm going to talk about other causes, other changes in PCV. So if we've got a normal PCV but a high total solids, then consider hyperglobulinemia. If you've got high PCVs but a low total solids, then there could be a decrease in protein production intake or increase in protein loss. If it's got a normal total protein with a high PCV, then consider polycythemia as a cause. And if both of them are high, then heme concentration is most likely. And these are not strict rules, but they give us a good guideline on what could be going on without spending too much money for the client. Once we've performed the PCV and total protein, then have a look at the serum colour. If there's hemolytic serum, then it's likely to have intravascular hemolysis. If it's got ecteric serum, like this sample here, then it's most likely either going to be intra or extravascular hemolysis, so a prehepatic cause, also a hepatic cause or posthepatic cause of ecteric serum. But if we've got a patient who's anemic and we have ecteric serum, then we're probably thinking more likely to be intra or extravascular hemolysis. One thing I just wanted to mention, I saw this article recently, And it's a validation of a smartphone-based point-of-care hemoglobin assay for use in dogs. So there's a lot of smartphone devices that are coming out. There's the ECG monitor. You can take photos when you're performing pathology using your smartphone. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot more advances in the future. But this device was developed to use in the field. So when the doctors are going to third world countries, they can't like necessarily take their big centrifuge and things like that. So they've developed this smartphone-based point-of-care hemoglobin assay. One of the benefits is that it only needs a very microscopic amount of blood, 0.003 mils, I think. And you get the results back immediately. However, you're looking probably about, I think, about £400 or so, or $400 to purchase this. So you need to think about, is it really beneficial for your practice? And it doesn't work so well when the serum's like enteric or lipemic also. But it may be something very useful. It hasn't been validated in larger animals, but you know, if you're going on to field work, or even if you're looking at dogs doing house calls, then maybe it potentially could be useful. Okay, so now that we've looked at our PCV, our total protein, we've looked at the serum color, then we can look at autoagglutination. So we see autoagglutination when there's anti-erythrocytic immunoglobulin antibodies, so with IMHA. And we really need to differentiate it from a viroid formation. So we place one drop of blood to 1 to 4 drops of saline and look for autoagglutination, like you can see on the slide here. To confirm that it's autoagglutination versus viroid formation, we should place a cover slip and perform microscopic examination. So this is what we're looking for with IMHA. The question is, do we perform a Coombs test or not? Coombs test is also looking at autoagglutination as well. So if the blood is already agglutinating, then I wouldn't really worry about sending a Coombs test off. But if you're highly suspicious of IMHA, but you're not seeing autoagglutination, then you can send off a Coombs test to confirm that. So we're still using our very, very small amount of blood here. And next step is to perform a blood smear. I like to use a capillary tube, just controlling the amount of blood I put on the blood smear. And I've put a bit of this picture here, but I'm sure everyone knows about performing blood smears. But I just put it here just so the lecture is complete. And also, we do have often students who do attend a lecture also. But from the blood smear, we're looking at red blood cell morphology, platelet count and clumping, neutrophil count and estimate, and leukocyte morphology. And a blood smear can give a lot of information for us. I'm just going to go briefly through a few things which I think is helpful in the emergency situation. It's not a complete clinical pathology lecture, but just a few tips on what might be helpful during the night when no one's around. So, you guys probably all know this, but the first thing we need to do is look at 10 times magnification and first look at the feathered edge. We want to look for platelet clumps, and I'll show you some later on, and looking at large cells if they're present or not. And we can get, if we scanned the whole slide, we can get an overview of like the red blood cell and white blood cell density and get a rough feel for the estimated proportion of white blood cells. We can then go to 40 to 50 times magnification, and that's when we can look at white blood cell morphology. And then we can go to oil immersion 100 times magnification, and that's where we can see the red blood cell morphology. So looking at the size, shape, and color of our red blood cells, and also performing a manual platelet count. So just looking at the red blood cells initially, so we'll talk about the red blood cells, we'll talk about the platelets, and we'll talk about the leukocytes in that order. So firstly, looking at the red blood cells, I've got this slide here, and I do find sometimes with lectures it's difficult to appreciate the color and things of cells. But what we're looking here is that we can see that actually all of the red blood cells are similar size and very similar color. So it's normochromic, normocytic red blood cells. So because they're all the same shape and same size, they're probably in same stage of its life cycle. So we're thinking this is likely to be a non-regenerative anemia. This one's a bit hard to appreciate, also a non-regenerative anemia. We're also looking a little bit in the feathered edge here, but you can see actually just scanning this whole slide, we've got maybe lots of red blood cells, but we're not seeing any white blood cells. If we're also not seeing many platelets either, then it's a little bit hard to appreciate on this magnification any platelet count being on the feathered edge. But if we're not seeing any platelets and we're not seeing any white blood cells, and it's likely non-regenerative anemia with pancytopenia. One of the common things that we often see is regenerative anemia. And here we've got one with also hemolysis. So first of all, looking at the red blood cell morphology, or size, we've got here anisocytosis. So you can see that this red blood cell is much bigger than this. So we've got different sizes in red blood cells. The next thing to look at is the color, so polychromasia. So you can see that they're different color red blood cells. So they're also at a different stage of development. So you can see that we've got a regenerative anemia. We know that there's hemolysis because we've got these ghost cells. I don't know if you can appreciate just a faint cell there, as well as spherocytes. So you've got or the whole red blood cell is a similar color. So you don't have if some of this is more normal here. So you've got the clear inside of the cells, but this one doesn't. So it's lost its shape due to injury. So we've got a regenerative anemia with some hemolysis. And just so you can see, there's a few platelets floating around. So it's unlikely to have concurrent thrombocytopenia. This is another example here. We've got anisocytosis, so different size cells. We've got polychromasia here. Got spherocytes here. And then you can appreciate some of these ghost cells floating around. And also, we've got a nucleated red blood cell. So, you can get regenerative anemia. So, in this case, you've got some polychromasia happening here, anisocytosis, so different size cells as well. So, we've got regenerative anemia. However, we've got different changes here. So, we've got an excentrocyte here. And you can see that little blob here is Heinz bodies. So we see centrocytes and Heinz bodies more so with toxic injury. So onions, garlic, zinc, copper, paracetamol, benzocaines, propofol in cats, and nitroprusside can cause these problems. But just as a side note, Heinz bodies can be seen in cats with diabetes, with hypothyroidism, and lymphoma. So just keep that in mind. So once we've performed our PCV, our total protein, and we've done look for autoagglutination, performed our blood smear for our anemic patients, the other few things to look at is looking at our platelets. So we'll talk about that next. And then other things, when we're taking blood samples, think about do we need a sample for check coags, antistrongylus, especially in this country, and should we take some samples and perform blood type and cross matching. So we'll talk about these things next. So our platelets. I've got this photo here of this cocker spaniel. You can see there's like a little petechiae there, and also this Yorkie Never forget to perform a really good physical examination, as this is actually the rear end of the Yorkie, if you can appreciate. We're about to take a temperature, and you can see all this ecchymosis everywhere in the skin. It's quite spectacular. So always put these two pictures here just to emphasize that always combine your pathology or your tests with a good physical examination. All right, so when we've got patients with these type of clinical signs, we need to think about, is it the platelet number? So is it thrombocytopenia, which is a problem, or could it be the function? So thrombocytopathia. Different causes of thrombocytopenia. There could be, I broadly categorize into decreased production, increased destruction, or increased consumption. And I'm not going to read through all of those differential diagnoses now. When we've got thrombocytopathia, so if our platelet counts are all normal, but we're still seeing those clinical signs, petechiae and ecchymosis, that's when you need to think about, could it be actually platelet dysfunction causing those clinical signs? So different drugs can cause it, uremia can. Anemia can also cause it, as well as hepatic disease, hypothermia, Ehlers-Danlos, DIC, and von Willebrand's disease. It's fairly uncommon, but we do see these things, so just keep it in the back of your mind. So if we first need to make sure what the platelet counts are. So as we have already mentioned, we want to look for platelet clumps in the feathered edge. And you can see the red blood cells. We've got neutrophil there. But these smaller ones here all clump together. They're our platelet clumps. And we can see this on the feathered edge at 10 times the magnification. So we don't need to go too crazy high. If we're seeing platelet clumps here, when we perform our manual platelet count, then our platelet count should actually be higher than what we're seeing. I always emphasize performing a blood smear, not just looking at your automated hematology machine results, because it can be inaccurate. And also in cats, it can be inaccurate because the platelet size is not too dissimilar to red blood cells, and it can be a little bit confusing for the machine. So once we've looked for platelet count, clumps, then we want to eventually examine the monolayer under a high power field at 100 times the magnification. And what we're looking for is these platelets here. What we want to do is count the number of these platelets. So we've got one, two, three, four here. And we want to do that in like about 5 to 10 fields. So one platelet equals 15 to 20,000 platelets. So normal platelet count, if we're just looking at our blood smear, is 12 to 15 per high power field. We will see those clinical signs of petechiae and ecchymosis and bleeding from mucosal surfaces if our total platelet count is less than 50,000. So equivalent to that is if we've got less than 1 to 2 platelets per high power field, then we're going to see these clinical signs. Other things to test for other than platelets is looking at coagulation in our bleeding patients. So this is one with severe bruising, and this one's here with severe hemorrhagic diarrhea that caused severe anemia. This dog actually needed a rapid blood transfusion. So always think about performing coags in our patients with HDE as well. So when we're talking about our coagulation, we divide our coagulation into primary or secondary coagulopathies. There is a new way that we look at coagulation, which is a cell-based model of coagulation, which some of you may have come across. But when we're doing our diagnostic workup, all of our diagnostic tests have actually been based on the primary and secondary method, and so it's actually easier to work through our cases using the old school primary and secondary coagulation cascades. So if we're looking at our primary, that's looking at our platelets, which we've already talked about. If we've got normal platelet count, then we can perform a buccal mucosal bleeding time, which unfortunately I don't have time to go through in this lecture. Looking at von Willebrand's disease and also platelet function. If we've kind of having more clinical signs of secondary causes, so they're more cavitary effusions rather than petechiae and ecchymosis, then we should be looking at PT and APTT. But these types of coagulopathies, I'll be looking at, both of these things. There's not a lecture on coagulation, but I will just briefly mention it here because sometimes we think about, what tests do we need to perform? So this is on the left-hand side, so this longer cascade of 12, 11, 8, and 9. So this is all the intrinsic pathway. And this is the extrinsic pathway, so tissue factor and factor 7. And our common pathway starts from here, so factor 10, 5, 2, which is also known as thrombin, and fibrinogen going into fibrin. So when we're performing our APTT and also our activated clotting time, we're testing our intrinsic pathway and our common pathway. When we're performing PT, we're testing for our extrinsic pathway and our common pathway. So that's how you should think about when you perform these tests. So if you've got, say, for example, a prolonged PT but a normal APTT, so that means our intrinsic pathway is normal and our common pathway is also normal. So it must be a problem of tissue factor and factor 7. And just briefly, like one of the most common coagulopathies that we see is actually when we've got prolonged PT and normal APTT. We often see that with vitamin K deficiency, with, like, for example, rodenticide intoxications. And that's because our factor 7 has the shortest half-life. So if we see prolonged PT and normal APTT, vitamin K deficiency is the most likely cause. And I've just highlighted in red all the factors which are vitamin K dependent, so 7, 9, 10, and 2. Just a quick way to remember things is, I always remember APTT does the intrinsic pathway because it's a longer pathway, and APTT is longer. APT and PT is shorter, so it's only got two letters, so it tests the shorter pathway. I know this one's intrinsic because one way to remember is so APTT can stand for play table tennis, and we play table tennis inside. PT stands for play tennis, and we play tennis outside. So that might be an easy way for you to remember, what test does what. When we're testing for PT and APTT, we can use some in-house machines, or we can also send it externally. If you don't have the machines, you can also get activated clotting time tubes. So that would test, if we go back to two slides, that just tests our intrinsic and our common pathway. So it's a little bit more limited than having a machine, but we can still test it. But with the activated clotting time, it will be a more later stage of coagulopathy that will see changes in it, because you need to have a higher deficiency in the clotting factors to have prolongation in activated clotting time compared to APTT. When we're thinking about coagulopathies and anemia, we should also test for angiostrongylus. It can cause any kind of coagulopathies as well as vasculitis. It can cause respiratory issues as it's lungworm, and can cause neurological issues mainly because we see intracranial or even intraspinal hemorrhage. To diagnose angiostrongylus, there's several tests that we can perform. More recently, there's the IDEXX SNAP test, which has a sensitivity of 85% and specificity of 100%. That's meaning if it's positive, it's definitely positive. If it's negative, it could still be positive. The gold standard is three fecal samples and performing a Behrmann's. So if I'm getting a negative result with the IDEXX SNAP test, I always collect three fecal samples and send it for Behrmann's. You can also, if you don't have the IDEXX SNAP test, it takes a while to get the Behrmann's, so you could perform a fecal smear and look for these little creatures here. Has 100% specificity. If you see it, you see it. But the sensitivity is fairly low. If you've got an anemic patient, don't forget to blood type and cross match if they've had a blood transfusion more than 4 days ago, or also if they have an unknown blood transfusion history, it will be safe to cross match also. I'm not going to go into detail, but I just wanted to remind you it's something good to do in emergency, especially if they're very, very anemic. Just take a blood sample at the same time, run it so you've got your answer there and then. Okay, so we've covered all of anemia and what blood samples we need for our anemic patients. While we're performing a blood smear, we should also look at our white blood cells. So, how can we interpret our leukogram in the emergency room? We can look at our automated machine counts, but I'll always emphasize performing a blood smear because what we want to do is actually look at the morphology of our white blood cells. If we don't have an automated machine count, that's totally fine as well because we can get a subjective estimate of our white blood cell count as well. But sending it off to the lab is the most accurate, but we have to do what we can do in an emergency. Why do I always emphasize performing a blood smear and looking at the leukogram? Often in emergency, we've got those patients, they come in and the owner's like, yeah, they're just not quite right. And so in those cases, you don't want to send home the dog or the cat if they're unwell, but they seem to be okay. But you're wondering, do they need further investigation for any infection or inflammatory diseases? So that can help in those cases. Neutropenia is a very serious problem. Compromises the immune system and also associated with quite serious diseases, and we'll talk about this in a moment. So it's always important to detect neutropenia very early on. So I want to know if a patient who's looking very ill, if they're neutropenic because it would need immediate treatment. Looking for a lack of inflammatory leukogram can be important with our emergency hypoadrenocortism patients and also leukemia. What we're looking for these immature bare neutrophils. So this is a bare neutrophil, so immature cell, and our mature segmented neutrophil sits next to it, so you can compare. Also, inflammatory neutrophils have like dull bodies that you can see here, cytoplasmic basophilia, and that foaminess. So another example of inflammatory leukogram, you can see all of these bands neutrophils here. And also this slide is another example. What I want to talk more on rather than neutrophilia is neutropenia, because our recognition of neutropenia and immediate action could be life-saving. So the different causes of neutropenia could be severe inflammation, and we're talking about neutropenia with left shift here. So sepsis, we can see neutropenia in. They're severely compromised, as well as they have an infection there. So in a lot of human studies, they talk about giving antibiotics within the first hour of presentation, and that can actually be life-changing. And so if you have a patient that you suspect is septic or looking very ill, always perform a blood smear and start broad-spectrum antibiotics if they're neutropenic. And it's the only time where I recommend prophylactic antibiotics. We can sometimes see it in severe systemic inflammatory response syndrome, so not an severe systemic inflammation not caused by infection. And also parvovirus dogs. Often we get a parvovirus negative test, but if they look like parvo and they smell like parvo and they're neutropenic, they're likely to be parvo, and we should treat them as parvo by barrier nursing and providing supportive care. So that's probably the most important causes of neutropenia, but other things to consider are bone marrow disease and also severe hypothermia. We've already briefly covered this, but it's important because our patients are immunocompromised. Talked about barrier nursing, use of antibiotics. So we covered all of those things. So now that we've performed our blood smear, I mean, there are a lot of other tests which can be life-saving in the emergency room. So we'll talk about them. So the first one I want to talk about, and it's very easy to do, and I'm sure you're all doing it, is the blood glucose. But I just thought I'd bring it out here because all of us forget, including myself sometimes. I really want to know if a patient is hypoglycemic because I want to pick out these septic patients that need immediate treatment. But it's also helpful in our emergency room because we often see decreased glucose production in severe hypoadrenocorticism patients. We can pick out our xylitol intoxication. We often see insulin overdoses as well as insulin-secreting tumors in our emergency room. So all very important stuff. It can be helpful in detecting hyperglycemia, especially monitoring our ketoacidotic patients. Other thing to emphasize, I know not everyone can measure electrolytes in-house, but it's becoming a lot more available these days. And I always highly recommend performing electrolytes in all of your emergency and very sick patients. Having in-house electrolytes is important if you're seeing lots of emergencies in sicky patients, because having the rapid return of results is crucial. Electrolyte abnormalities can be life-threatening, so by correcting it straight away can be life-saving. So first of all, we'll talk about potassium because it's one of the most common ones that abnormalities that we see. If we have hyperkalemia, we can have arrhythmias and bradycardia. And also having a look at our ECG trace. So often we first see a tall peak T wave, widened QRS complex here, decreased R wave amplitude, a wide or flattened P wave, and a depressed ST segment, which is down here. So look for these things if they're hyperkalemic. Often, if they've been chronically hyperkalemic and all gradually getting higher, you don't see those changes straight away, but if it's more acute, we're more likely to see those arrhythmias. We can also see arrhythmias in hyperkalemic patients if it's severely hyperkalemic. But I appreciate that sometimes, we can't measure potassium. Maybe our machine's broken and we don't even have a machine. And that's okay. If you have an ECG, just place your ECG, measure your heart rate and just look for any of these ECG changes. If you've got a patient who you suspect might be hyperkalemic, say your block cat, you can't measure potassium, but you can see on the ECG, or if they are bradycardic and you don't have an ECG, consider treatment for hyperkalemia. Different causes of hyper and hypokalemia I've just put here for completeness and for your own reference, but I'm not going to read through these in detail, but it could be renal causes or other potential causes as well. I'll get you to read through that in your own time. And for treatment of hyperkalemia, I couldn't not include this. So initially, diuresis with IV fluids, very important. I usually give calcium gluconate first before the other therapy, and that's for membrane stabilization to help resolve the arrhythmias, because that's going to act more rapidly than these other treatments below here. So start that first and help the arrhythmia if it's present. Then I usually give 50% dextrose and regular insulin together. If they're actually like only very mildly hyperkalemic but you're still a bit worried, you can just give the dextrose and don't worry about the insulin, because the insulin will cause hyperglycemia and a little bit of a pain to manage our patients. Sodium bicarbonate I give in patients who are severely acidemic and also hyperkalemic. Those conditions happen concurrently very often, or ones which are refractory to the above treatment. Just because sodium bicarbonate can have its adverse effects as well. So my first line therapy would be dextrose and insulin, but sodium bicarbonate in refractory cases and also severely acidemic patients. And finally, we often forget that terbutaline can also be helpful. So if those things aren't working, that's another drug that you can try. Next one to measure is sodium, and I always want to measure sodium in my neuro patients. Can cause obtundation, head pressing, seizures, and death in hyper or hyponatremic patients. The other thing to remember is rapid changes in sodium concentration can also cause neurological derangements. So be careful about giving water to dogs, because if they've been starved of water, causing severe hyponatremia, and you suddenly give them lots of water like this guy, then potentially they could have seizures and neurological deficits. And it's important, if you are seeing a lot of critical patients and a lot of emergency patients, of actually having an in-house monitor. So because when we're treating for these conditions, we need to be measuring sodium every 4 hours at least. So when we're thinking about sodium concentration, it's a little bit hard to appreciate here, but let's say the yellow circles are our sodium ions and the blue ones are our water molecules. So when we're measuring sodium, we're measuring the proportion of sodium compared to our water. If that makes sense, this might help you understand. So if we've got hypernatremia, we either have sodium excess, so things like salt poisoning, iatrogenic causes, or we can have a free water deficit. So that could be a free water loss or inadequate free water gain. If we've got hyponatremia, we can have free water excess, so for example polydipsia, or sodium deficit, so GI causes, hypoadrenocorticism, diuretics, and other causes as well. This is a big topic. I'm only just going to very, very briefly give you a small tip on treating hypernatremia, but I can do a whole lecture on hypernatremia and hyponatremia. What we want to do is replace our free water deficit at the same rate as the hypernatremia developed. We can use this funky calculation here. So patient sodium divided by the normal sodium minus 1, all of that multiplied by 0.6 times body weight. And we need to replace this amount using free water, and free water is 5% dextrose solution. If we actually administered, you know, free water that we can purchase in a sterile bottle, it's so hypoosmolar that when we administer it, it can injure cells. And that's why instead of free water alone, just water alone, we give a solution which has 5% dextrose. Most of the time, we don't know how quickly the free water deficit, the hypernatremia or free water deficit occurs. So if it's an unknown time frame, we need to make sure our sodium decreases no faster than 0.5 to 1 millimole per liter per hour. And we can use this formula and this to work that out. But this is a slight cheating method. That's 3.7 mils per kilo per hour of free water administered to any patient would cause a decrease in sodium at 1 millimole per liter per hour. So if you've got a hyponatremic patient, you can probably safely give a 5% dextrose solution at this rate, and we should have a decrease in sodium at 1 millimole per liter per hour. I still recommend checking your sodium every 4 hours initially, because this is only a rough guess, because it's the different causes of the hyponatremia will also alter how quickly our sodium will be corrected or not corrected. Next, what emergency tests important in our neurological patients is calcium. Hypocalcemia can cause things like muscle twitching, facial rubbing, or neurological disease. So as hyperkalemia, sorry, hypercalcemia can cause neurological issues, muscle twitching, as well as PUPD. It's important to measure ionized calcium if possible, because these are the ones which are not attached to protein and which are actually causing our clinical signs. Just briefly, here are the differentials for hypocalcemia and hypercalcemia. I'll let you read through that in your own time. And treatment for hypocalcemia and hypercalcemia. If they're hypocalcemic and they're not showing clinical signs, so you just run your general blood tests, the electrolytes and blood gas machine that I use does measure ionized calcium at the same time, so it's a good emergency screen. So you might see incidentally, but if they're not showing clinical signs, just let them be. If they are showing clinical signs, then administer 10% calcium gluconate at 0.5 to 1.5 mil per kilo over 10 to 20 minutes, and you should be monitoring your heart rate. Then, depending on how things are going, then you might want to consider a CRI at 1 to 3 mil per kilo per hour, plus or minus calcitriol, depending on the underlying cause. Hypercalcemia, if you see it, then I usually try these things in this particular order. So starting with 0.9% sodium chloride. If that doesn't work, then furosemide. If that doesn't work, then dex or pred, followed by sodium bicarbonate and calcitonin. Other things to look at is looking at our kidney function. Not only kidney function, but I'm talking about azotemia in general. So, firstly, our urea. If we have an increase in urea, it could be azotemic, but don't forget our GIT hemorrhage. I also always recommend performing a rectal exam in our patients as a complete physical examination, because we can detect these GI hemorrhage. It can also be due to decreased production, so think about our patients reported systemic shunt and hepatic failure. So when in any cases, don't just look for high values, look for low values as well. Next one is creatinine. So this is increase in azotemia. And if they're azotemic, think about our pre-renal versus renal and post-renal. And perform a urinalysis, ideally before IV fluids are given, but if not, you can still perform it once we've started IV fluids, because often there might not be a bladder. So supporting our urea and creatinine, always perform a urinalysis. Things to look at is our colour. So is it hemoglobinuria or hematuria? So always spin our urine sample down. Measure our urine-specific gravity, urine dipstick, and don't forget our wet prep exam, which a lot of people forget to do. So we want to look at our crystals. So could it be, struvite crystals could be causing some kind of urethral obstruction. If there's ammonium urate crystals, that may support portosystemic shunts. and looking at calcium oxalate crystals might support ethylene glycol toxicity. Yes, we will see them in other diseases, but I'm just talking about things that help us in the emergency. Also, look for granular casts. We see very small amounts can be normal, but we see them in acute kidney injury. So anything like, say, for example, cat-eaten lily, always look at our granular casts. And because granular casts are shed from tubular injury, we sometimes see them before we see even azotemia, which is why I always emphasize performing your urinalysis. Perform cytology of our urine and also culture and sensitivity of our cystocentesis sample, even if we don't see any signs of inflammation or infection on our cytology. Especially when urine is dilute, it's going to be very difficult to identify bacteria and inflammatory cells, so culture and sensitivity is always indicated. So that is basically the tests that I recommend performing in our emergency room. I know we covered lots of things there, and a lot of broad topics, but I hope you've got like a brief overview of, what we can do with just a small drop of blood, what tests are important in immediate treatment, etc. So, thank you for listening to today's webinar, and I hope you were able to get some good information out of it, which will be helpful in your next emergency. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Deanna for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.